From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. And on today's show, President-elect Barack Obama campaigned for the White House with a message of unity. Unity across racial divides, unity across partisan divides. But what about unity across religious divides? Coming up, we've got advice on creating interfaith dialogue. And let me tell you, friends, in today's world, these are conversations we cannot afford not to have. Plus, the election of George W. Bush was a watershed moment for the religious right, but what will an Obama administration mean for the religious left? And who is the religious left? We'll find out. But first, religion makes an appearance before the High Court. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case involving the town of Pleasant Grove City, Utah. In the 1970s, the city of Pleasant Grove accepted a monument of the Ten Commandments as a gift from the Fraternal Order of the Eagles. The city displayed the monument in a public park, and now a religious group known as Summum would like for the city to display a monument to their religious beliefs. The group would like to erect a statue in that same park dedicated to the sect's seven aphorisms or guiding principles. But the city of Pleasant Grove has refused. And now the Supreme Court of the United States must decide whether a municipality can accept and display one monument and reject another. Here with me now to discuss that important case is Los Angeles Times Supreme Court correspondent David Savage. David, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Now, Summum is, as I understand it, not arguing that the city's giving preferential treatment to one religion over the other and thereby violating the Establishment Clause. Summum is saying this is a matter of free speech. What's the argument?
This is sort of a constitutional quagmire where there's both religion and speech issues circling around. They are relying on sort of an old doctrine that the Supreme Court's talked about as sort of the public forum doctrine. It's something like if you have a public park or a public bandshell and anybody can speak, the government can't discriminate in favor of some speakers and against others. Mm. It's open free speech. And so they've basically made the argument that, look, you, the city, have accepted monuments from private groups with their message on them, and we deserve the same right. You can't discriminate against us because you don't like our message. And remarkably, that argument won in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Denver.
Do you think then that as they envision this legally, that they see it as easier to win the case from that free speech position than going down the road of challenging the city for displaying the Ten Commandments in the first place?
Well, you know, challenging it, the Ten Commandments as establishment of religion wouldn't get them anywhere. You know, what I think a lot of people were surprised when they see this case is saying, why didn't the ACLU go into court and say, what is the city doing erecting the Ten Commandments in a public park? That's usually how these cases arise. some group like the ACLU says the government should not be sponsoring or promoting religion. Mm-hmm. But Summum didn't want to get rid of the Ten Commandments. They just wanted, in effect, equal treatment for their religion.
How do you think it went when the court heard the arguments this past week? I was a little surprised, I must admit, to hear some of Chief Justice Roberts' comments, which seemed to challenge the city's action. I figured the conservative judges would naturally side in favor of the city. How did you hear it?
Well, I think Roberts will have a majority to say there is no free speech violation here. The city was entitled to, if you just look at this as a monument with a message, the city is entitled to accept one message in a monument. As he said, if you have a statute of liberty, you don't have to have a statute of fascism or whatever.
Yeah.
That's part of the government's message, and therefore I think they will reject the free speech claim. But everybody knows the really harder question that the Supreme Court hasn't resolved is can the city or a county have the Ten Commandments or some other explicitly religious monument on its grounds? The court has been sort of split 5-4 on that issue for a very long time. I would guess that they will take that up in the next year or two, come up in some other case, and then they're going to focus on the really hard question that you were alluding to in the beginning, which is, can the government give a sort of special favoritism to a religion by putting up on public property a monument, in this case, to the Ten Commandments?
Well, you've been watching the court intently. Is this case going to tell us anything new about the current temperature on the court around issues of public displays of religion?
I don't think it will tell us a whole lot if they follow through and decide this is a free speech case, because I think most of them are not going to buy the idea that this is really an open-ended free speech matter. What it would be interesting to see is if they then write and say, how do we view the Ten Commandments? Because, as I say, you could view it as explicitly religious. You could view it as part of our heritage. And so I think it'd be interesting to see what they say on that. But I do believe the really hard question comes next is, there's a case from California I just wrote about where the government is appealing. There was a cross erected in the Mojave National Forest. It's been there for a long time. It began as a war memorial, but it's been challenged by the ACLU and basically said, you can't have a large cross on federal land. It's an endorsement of religion. And the Federal Appeals Court out in California agreed. The Bush administration has appealed that case to the Supreme Court. And I think there's a pretty good bet that the court will take a case like that to then try to decide this really hard question is, can you have an explicitly religious monument on public land?
I hope our listeners actually will look up the article you did. I've read it, and it's a great article, and it has more complications, which we can't talk about here, because even Congress got involved in that one and made laws to try to circumvent the constitutional law on it.
Well, and this also comes up. You can bet a month from now we will read something in the paper somewhere that some city or town will have a Christmas display with a manger scene, a creche, and somebody, the ACLU or whatever, will challenge it. And that's always a difficult question is, can you have a display? Can the city have a display like that because it's part of the traditional Christmas season? Or is somebody else going to say, no, you really can't because that's the government promoting and endorsing religion, and the government shouldn't do that. It's a recurring fight, and part of the reason it's a recurring fight is the Supreme Court has never been able to clearly rule either yes or no on that question.
David Savage is Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. David, you've helped us immensely understand this case, and we're going to watch it closely, and maybe you can come back on State of Belief and we can talk about it some more.
I would be glad to do it.
Thanks for doing today.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up on State of Belief, as the religious right is dealt a blow with the Obama victory, will the religious left rise in its place? And what will this mean for religion in the public square? We got to take a short break, but when we return, a look at faith and politics again. Blue State style this time. Stay tuned, friends. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Political pundits, newspaper editorial boards, and many in the religious community have been announcing the death of the religious right for years, and undoubtedly the religious right is in a difficult spot these days with the defeat of John McCain, the firestorm surrounding social conservative poster girl Sarah Palin, and the subsequent division within the Republican Party. But look, in my opinion, never say die when it comes to the religious right. I believe the religious right's leaders are already hard at work on efforts to regroup and strengthen the movement in an Obama administration. It's powerful stuff when you're playing Theo and trying to create a theocracy, and they're not about to give that up. But what about the religious left during the next 4 years? Now, you could argue that they now have an ally in the White House, a Democrat dedicated to social justice and certainly not afraid to talk about his strong religious beliefs. The question is, will the left ever be able to reach the level of influence that the religious right has enjoyed during its heyday? Well, joining me now to answer those questions and more is journalist Frederick Clarkson. He's the editor of a new book of essays written by a variety of progressive religious leaders with advice for building a stronger religious left. This book is called Dispatches from the Religious Left: The Future of Faith and Politics in America. Fred Clarkson, I must mention, is also the co-founder of the blog Talk to Action. Fred, welcome back to State of Belief.
Oh, very glad to be here.
When you started to do a book on the religious left, how in the world did you know who to talk to?
There were some people who I thought of right away who I knew I had to have, just because I knew them, I knew their work, and I thought, that's the kind of person that I want. But first I had to figure out, well, what is the religious left?
Right.
And my frame of reference has always been thinking about the religious right for many years. Mm-hmm. So if you define the religious right as a powerful social and political movement, maybe the most powerful religious political movement we've ever seen in American history, and you look around and you say, well, there's nothing remotely like that over on the left. And so you have to look at who then would have some vision for what the political pieces of a religious left might be like. And there's some of those out there. But more importantly, how could they be greater than the sum of their parts? So I wanted to find people who could answer questions like that.
Now, I'm guessing that another challenge after you identify what the religious left is, if you're looking at the religious right, regardless of where you go in that movement, you have people that stay on message. You hear a consistent voice and a consistent message. In the religious left, you have people all over the ideological territory, some interested in stem cell research, some interested in gay marriage, some interested in reproductive health, environmental issues, on and on it goes. So did you feel like you heard a distinctive message from the religious left? In other words, the left is very diverse in its interests.
Well, it is, and the religious right is too. They're not as monolithic as we sometimes think that they are. But you're right. I think that the left is highly atomized and deals in highly specialized issues and sticks to their silos and won't come out.
Yeah.
And that really is going to be one of the major challenges for figuring out how to be greater than the sum of our parts.
There are two phenomena that I think impact the religious left, certainly in the way the left is perceived, and I want to ask you about both of them. I have heard some people in the secularist tradition say, well, the religious left is nothing but the religious right in progressive clothing. Now, is that true? Do they have something to worry about with the religious left?
I don't think so. I think that that's a lot of hooey. And in its worst form is anti-religious bigotry. The religious left, in my experience, personally, and in history, is they're the greatest allies of non-religious people, the people who've been in the lead for the right of individual conscience and the separation of church and state. I think that religious progressives and non-believers of all sorts, regardless of their political ideology, have a great deal in common.
Let me ask you about the other end of that spectrum. There is, debatably, this so-called emerging middle, people coming out of the religious right but more progressive because of their views on the environment and hunger and a few other things. Do religious left members have anything to worry about regarding this emerging middle? For example, I heard someone say the other day, I'm afraid the public is going to confuse the emerging middle with the religious left. Do you have any concern about that?
Oh, well, absolutely. I think that's the way they're being presented by elements of the Democratic Party and elements of the media. We see no better example than the former head of the Christian Coalition, Joel Hunter, being presented as a Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. He's a conservative and a Republican. He's anti-gay marriage and he's anti-choice. And yet he's portrayed as this indicator of moderation in evangelicalism. And he gets together with people like Jim Wallace, and people say, well, that's the religious left. That's pretty far from it.
Now, when that happens, does that make you want to stand up and say, no, that's not who they are?
Well, indeed. I think that religious progressives need to find their voice, and they need to find ways to get heard, because the inside the Beltway crowd, no matter how much they may talk about change, are really about the status quo. And they need to find people who are going to be willing to help them to keep it. And if there's anything that's characteristic of the religious left, is it stands in the prophetic tradition of Martin Luther King, William Sloan Coffin, Rabbi Abraham Heschel. And speaking truth to power actually means speaking truth to power and not merely going along for the Democratic Party ride.
Fred Clarkson is the editor of a new book, Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. A really good insight into an important movement in our nation. You can also check out Fred's writing on the blog, Talk to Action. Fred, it's always good to have you on State of Belief, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Wilson. Anytime.
I'm Welton Getty, and this is State of Belief. We've got to take another quick break, and when we come back, a look at interfaith dialogue in the 21st century, advice for those hoping to reach across faith lines. That's coming right up next. Stay tuned. And this is State of Belief. America is one of the most religiously diverse countries in the world. To some, that could seem like a problem, a breeding ground for conflict among different faiths. For others, like myself, our diverse population is a unique opportunity, a source of blessing. An opportunity not just to live among other religions, but an opportunity to explore the different religious traditions that surround us. And for those of you interested in interfaith work, but not quite sure how to proceed, a new book will prove to be a very useful resource. The book is called Interactive Faith. It offers concrete advice in how to reach across boundaries and create meaningful dialogue between faiths. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell you, I authored a chapter in this book. But today, we're not talking about my contribution. Rather, the contributions of my two guests and fellow authors, the Reverend Dr. Clark Lobenstein and the Reverend Dr. Francis Tizo. Clark Lobenstein is director of the Interfaith Conference of Metropolitan Washington, and Francis Tizo is director of interreligious affairs of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Welcome, both of you, to State of Belief.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
Clark, in your chapter in the book, you concentrate on the practice of interfaith prayer. And for those of us who aren't versed in interfaith work, that might seem like an oxymoron. Most people would say prayer is often thought of as unique to each religious tradition. Catholic prayer differs from Jewish prayer. Jewish prayer differs from Muslim prayer. So how do you create an interfaith prayer?
Well, one very simple but a very important guideline is that when I pray in an interfaith setting, I want to pray in a way in which everyone can say amen. Now, the Vatican years ago, in the context of the Assisi meetings, the Assisi meeting in which Pope John Paul brought together persons of many religions, followed the guideline that some still work on today to come together to pray, each in our own tradition, mm-hmm. as opposed to coming to pray together in a way in which everyone can say amen. Mm-hmm. And if I choose, maybe in a sermon or in another context, to be more specific, maybe reading of scriptures or whatever, I want to make clear that this is coming from my tradition, and it's not something that I'm reading or saying in the context of a sermon that everyone necessarily has to agree to.
You have in the book a really great story about a ceremony in which you married a Muslim man and a Christian woman, and that you needed to find a way to make both families feel welcome and included, and you say that the simplest thing you did turned out to be the most important. Tell us what you did.
Well, consistently in the service, I refer to God or I refer to Allah, and sometimes to both, but usually just one or the other. And I found afterwards that the Muslim who are present for this ceremony were so grateful that I would use the term Allah. Well, Allah is simply Arabic for God. Arab Christians talk about Allah, not God, if they're speaking in their native language. But it just was very simple, but yet very meaningful that in that context I did that.
Well, Francis, I know you do a lot of work with Catholic-Muslim relations. I was thinking, with immigration obviously impacting the religious makeup of our country, you say that Catholics have a unique opportunity to reach out to Muslim immigrants. What, if you dialogue around that issue, what are the subtopics? What's the substance of that conversation? What should it be like?
Okay, one of the topics that comes up very, very strong is the problem of Islamophobia. And Catholics have had experiences in our different ethnic groups as ethnic Catholics with prejudice in the past and even acts of violence. I'm reading a novel now about life in Boston just after World War I. It wasn't so easy to be a person who looked different, let me tell you, in those days of paranoia about Red Scares, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so today we have a lot of challenges in the area of people misunderstanding Muslim motives, conduct, belief, commitments, religious observances, their architecture, and so forth. And so there's a lot of controversy. Some of that has been stirred up by mass media and DVDs that have been sent out. So we talk about that, and we try to compare notes on ways to cope with this and ways to keep our communities peaceful and at peace in spite of the fact that sometimes there are controversies.
Francis, I know that conversations between Catholics and Muslims pick up on a weight, actually, I would call it, that impacts a lot of interreligious discussions, and that's the weight of the past, because some people so identify one particular religion with what they have learned about that religion from the past that it impacts the way in which the conversation takes place in the present. How do you get people out of the past to deal with where they are right now?
That is a very tough question. In fact, one of the things that I've been asking our bishops about is what are the areas about Catholicism that you would want to be sure that people of other faiths know? That's one question. And the other question is, what are some of the historical obstacles to understanding one another that linger on? Of course, I read widely myself. It's one of my bad habits. It's very interesting to see how some of the old prejudices just continue on almost unabated. Things like, you know, Catholics are backward, you know, and somehow Protestants, like my good friend Clark, you're ahead of everybody. You know, you're the thrust of civilization. Catholics had it for a while, but they lost it. You know, and then Muslims fit into this scale somehow as people who had it and lost it also. And when we sit down and talk with our Muslim friends, you know, they're astonished because they don't see themselves that way. Or if they do, they say it was the fault of colonialism, which did in fact damage the Muslim traditional education system in many countries. So we talk about these things, and the general impression that people have about our past, and the fact is that we are influenced by that, you might say, narrative or even mythology, shall we say, of the past. And it makes us unable to live fully present to our neighbors in the present. But the fact of the matter is, it's hard to forget the past. Mm-hmm. I think maybe what we need to do is forgive and make reparation for the past.
Mm, yes.
I'm reminded of a Christian who grew up in the Middle East and is frequently speaking in gatherings with Muslims, and who says that he still feels the need to apologize for the Crusades almost 1,000 years later, because until he has done that, the air is not really cleared of some of this past baggage. Yeah. And it's a frightening reminder of the power of that past. I've had Irish people tell me that the differences among that the Battle of Orange 400 years ago was like it happened yesterday. Now, for many, it hasn't, but I think one of the signs of hope that I didn't mention in our opening reflections was the sign of hope of the current generation, those who were in their 20s and 30s, who largely have grown up in a time of knowing peoples of different faiths and races and cultures, of having very different perspectives on that than their parents or their grandparents may have. I think we certainly saw that in the last presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But those are opportunities and challenges that face us in this interreligious setting, which the 21st century clearly is.
Okay, now listen, I've got to interrupt because we're out of time, but I want to do something we don't have time to do. So you're going to have to answer in no more than two sentences each. Why is interreligious, interfaith dialogue important to everybody?
Well, it's important to everybody because we all live in a planet filled with peoples of many faiths, and if we don't know how to get along with each other, we're going to find ways to hurt each other, kill each other, blow each other up, and much worse.
Francis?
I'd second that, and I would also warn that people who do not understand religions will not be able not only to understand their neighbors, will not be able even to love their neighbors, and as a result will not be able to cooperate with their neighbors. And if we want to have a society that is multicultural, and we already have it, we need to develop that kind of love which comes from considered knowing. This is about education, and I'm committed to it myself.
My guests are Francis Tizzo, Director of Interreligious Affairs of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and Clark Lobenstein from the Interfaith Conference of Metropolitan Washington. They are both contributors to a new book called Interactive Faith. Look it up. You'll appreciate them even more after you look at the book. And thanks to the two of you for being with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you very much. Good
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Take care.
Take care, Clark.
I'm Welton Getty, and this is State of Belief. And coming up, an interfaith message to President-elect Barack Obama. Congregations from a variety of religious traditions converged in front of the White House this week find out what they had to say. We'll be back in just a minute. Don't you go anywhere. You'll be particularly interested in this segment. Everybody, I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. In October 2007, the New York Times published a report documenting the Bush administration's secret authorization of brutal interrogation techniques. Then-Senator Barack Obama responded to this information by saying the following: "When I am president, America will once again be the country that stands up to these deplorable tactics. When I am president, we won't work in secret to avoid honoring our laws and Constitution. We'll be straight with the American people and true to our values." Well, now that Mr. Obama has become our president-elect, a group of religious leaders hopes to keep him true to his earlier promise. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture is made up of more than 240 religious groups, all working together to end the practice of torture. This past Wednesday, the group led a National Day of Witness Against Torture. More than 50 delegations of religious leaders met with members of Congress around the country, and the day culminated with a demonstration outside the White House. Take a listen to this group.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is an event of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, and we're asking the president-elect to issue an executive order banning torture. That's why we're here.
He's got executive privilege. Why again?
My name is Rabbi Merrill Crean, and I'm from a congregation at Martin's Run Senior Living Community, which is a retirement community. I am the rabbi of a multitude of Jewish sects, so it's all the whole spectrum of Jewish life there. As you heard the speaker say, torture denies the divinity of God in every human being, the torturer and the tortured, and as a country, which is supposedly based on human values and on democracy and the rule of law, to sanction torture for any reason is wrong and ill-advised. So it's morally wrong, and it's politically and intellectually, you know, unproductive.
Today, more than 50 religious delegations across the nation are visiting members of Congress.
My name is James Egan. I am from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm among two people representing Brown Memorial Presbyterian Church. I believe it was Benjamin Franklin who once said that a society that sacrifices liberty for the sake of security deserves neither. That really spells out my feeling about the disaster of injustice that's been visited on the world and our nation as well.
Join me in prayer. Oh God, we're grateful for the
Suzanne O'Hatnick, and I'm a member of Stony Run Friends Meeting in Baltimore. I've been working with the National Religious Campaign Against Torture since its beginning, actually. And I guess I started when I saw the pictures of Abu Ghraib and started following the news, and just felt that as a citizen, I could not bear knowing that about my country and my government and not do anything.
You know, we're here because we love our country, because our country has the potential for being good and hence to be great. And Linda Ryden will sing for us.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, my name is Dr. Johanna Mariam, I came from Ethiopia. I'm tortured by this.
I'm with the group too, Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition. And it's an organization that was founded by and all the members are torture survivors.
About torture, torture is wrong. All this way, we need explain for Mr. Obama, for the Democrat, for the new president. Yeah.
I'm Alice. Alice Monte. I'm a survivor, and it's such a difficult situation. And when you are in a country, we believe U.S. is a country of democracy, where a country you can rely on. And Obama is just a hope for everybody. And I believe with the help of Obama, we can fight the torture across the boundaries. And that's why I'm here, to support those who have not had the luck like me to escape from the torture and being here.
I'm Welton Gaddy, and you were just listening to voices from a demonstration led by the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. Well, friends, we're just about out of time for today, but last week I asked you to send me your memos to the next president, thoughts that you'd like to share with Barack Obama. And I want to read to you one of the responses I received. A listener named Beverly wrote in with some concrete suggestions for Mr. Obama. She mentioned the need to close Guantanamo, improve our public transportation, schools, and hospitals. I wish I had time, but I don't, to read all of Beverly's very fine memo today, but I'd like to share with you her closing words, because I found them very inspirational. Beverly writes, "This election showed us that a new generation is mobilized and ready to work. Let's show them what their active citizenship can do." One of the sentiments continually repeated during World War II was that America had no hope of winning any war unless every citizen was called upon to sacrifice. Today, we not only face military conflict abroad, but economic and social crisis at home. As good citizens, we must all be willing to do our part to restore our country. Beverly, thank you so much for your comment and for everyone else listening. Do you have a message for the president-elect? Go to stateofbelief.com and click on the Contact Us page. Do be in touch with us. Let us know what you think of the show, and let us know what you think ought to be on the show. Make sure to tune in next week. A member of the Kennedy family will join us to talk about what it means to be a Catholic today. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.